Thumbtack presents the ins and outs of caring for your home. Out. Uncertainty. Self-doubt. Stressing about not knowing where to start. In. Plans and guides that make it easy to get home projects done. Out. Word art. Sorry, live, laugh, lovers. In. Knowing what to do, when to do it, and who to hire. Start caring for your home with confidence. Download Thumbtack today.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
You don't just live in your home. You live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
97.1 FM Talk Podcast.
Oh, I told you we were 80s influenced today. Yeah, I didn't have this one on the bumper list either, Naked Eyes. Used to play this one on the radio quite a bit, right? Promises, promises. I'll put the playlist up at the end of the show, and I've been putting together a Spotify list for the music. I'm real excited. You know, I did not even know. I told Fred, I said, I want to talk about this Karen Reed trial.
Oh,
find
yeah.
out if Paul Morrow's on top of this. Oh, yeah, he is.
Good.
And I watched the series on Max. I'm totally all in on this, and you will be too when you hear the details, because it's a crazy case and there's so many weird things that happen. And again, I think she's guilty as hell, but it doesn't matter. It's still very entertaining. So
okay.
We'll get with Paul. We'll have an audio cut of the day coming up as well toward the end of the hour. One of my options for audio cut of the day, I have some Scott Jennings audio today that I have not shared. Most of that audio came in a link from David Strom's piece on hotair.com. So I thank you for that, David Strom. How are you as we start this week on a Monday?
I am exceptional. I am the temporary boss because Ed is gone, which means precisely nothing, because we're all very independent. I can't even tell someone, hey, you should write about this.
Wow, look at that. Ed Morrissey, the boss over at hotair.com. So you're kind of going rogue, is that what you're saying?
Absolutely, and everyone else who writes there is completely ignoring me.
Well, on the Jennings front, because I guess he should have told me that my damn friend in Louisville didn't even tell me, and you had some audio. There was a clip he admitted during a podcast that he has re-upped, or he's about to re-up for 3 years on CNN, and they asked him, and I've asked Scott this too, are they going to give him his own show? I think that that's not necessarily going to happen right now, but look, he's the only person keeping things sort of straight and sane over on CNN right now, Strom. I think you know that.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I chat with him a little bit on X. You know, he sends me links to stuff. And several times I told him, don't leave CNN. Don't leave CNN. You know, you go to Fox News and you'll be, you know, teaching the choir how to sing.
That's a good
and
point.
They already know all the words. You know, we need the people who watch CNN to get a little dose of sanity. And you know, it's good for the ratings and it's good for him. And I think ultimately it's good for the country that we have someone like Scott, who is just so calm, cool, collected, and in touch with the facts, actually speaking to people, because otherwise almost everyone else on that channel is insane.
David, he's become a national treasure, but the problem is that he's a dear friend of mine, and I got to keep that ego in check, you know? Man, he's got attention from everywhere, so that's part of my role is, because he's on the LA Times editorial board now, you know, he's on, I told him there was a period because everything took off in the aftermath of that first debate, and I remember, you know, we had a debate watch party at Dave and Buster's, and I got into the car right after that thing ended because I wanted to know what Van Jones and Jennings and those guys said, and that was was kind of the night that, you know, he broke out into a different stratosphere, if you will, because he hasn't really said anything different than he's been saying the past several years on CNN. But, you know, the attention that he got all of a sudden, this is one of the things I think I told him around about September, I couldn't, you know, even find another pundit or maybe even a column on Hot Air that wasn't name-checking him.
Yep. Yeah, well, I mean, Scott really has broken through and broken out, you know, for a few reasons. I didn't realize he had been there since 2017. I mean, yeah, he's been on CNN for quite a while, and he actually has spoken with great gratitude about how CNN has really given him room to grow. But you're absolutely right. It was over this last campaign that he broke out. And I think at least part of it has to do with the fact that Scott actually sort of, he straddles two lines. I mean, he's been part of the Republican establishment. He knows what they do, how they think. You know, he's worked on the Hill. He was a Trump skeptic originally.
Worked for George W. Bush in the administration, worked with Mitch McConnell for Mitch McConnell. But yeah, very, very skeptical in the first administration. No doubt about that.
Yeah. And what's happened is that he had, as I think a lot of people who've been lifelong Republicans have had, this sort of, you know, gestalt shift about Trump. We finally get him. In a way that it was just so hard originally, because those of us who've been deeply involved in Republican politics have sort of an instinctive distrust of populist politics, because it, you know, it's necessary to have people who hold the establishment in check, but it's also dangerous when people don't understand how government works to get super passionate about stuff. And Trump has ridden that line extremely well. And people like Scott, people like me, probably someone like you.
Yep. Same evolution. I've had, yeah, similar evolution. There's no doubt about that. And, you know, it's funny. So the quick story on Jennings that goes back literally 30 years. When I went to Milwaukee, I was doing a morning show at WTMJ, and in the morning I would listen to WHAS radio from Louisville because I knew the station. I had gone to the Kentucky Derby. I loved the station. It was actually a market that I could have envisioned myself, you know, working in. There was a guy by the name of Joe Arnold that did the overnight show, and I was listening to him, and lo and behold, my station hired his boss. So I, in the early days of email, I sent him an email. I said, hey, I need some dirt on this guy that we just hired, and Joe and I became friends. And what I didn't realize is, you fast forward to that period that you're just referring to, 2017, I'm at the Derby, and Joe's like, look, you gotta meet my friend Scott Jennings. He's like rising star in media. He runs campaigns here. So I met Jennings. What I realized was that when Joe did that overnight show, David, he had Jennings on as his news anchor. And we're talking like 1998, 1999, 2000.
Wow.
Jennings is doing like an overnight newscast on WHAS. And that's kind of how he got his start before he did the politics thing. So I was very fortuitous because Joe introduced me to him, and he's been on my show ever since for the past 8 years, you know, because of our relationship. And the other thing that's a big part of it for St. Louis is he loves our St. Louis Cardinals. So that's a big, when he knew I was on KMOX, my previous station, that was one of the things, you know, that certainly interested him. But his evolution has been something. It really has been something to watch from, you know, near and afar. But let's talk about some more of these issues here. And I'm dying to hear your take. We didn't talk last week on the whole Signal controversy, because obviously this was the big story of last week. I haven't heard a lot of talk about it this week. We seem to be talking about different things. There was clearly a mistake that was made. I think everyone has pretty much admitted that at this point. Mike Walz's name has still been tossed out there as someone who might have to take a fall for this. But what's your take on that whole situation?
Well, you know, I'm sort of I'm with you. A real mistake was made. You know, I would call it a 2 or 3 out of 10 on the mistake meter, maybe even a 4, but you're also in a no harm, no foul area. And, you know, and the Democrats have obviously latched onto this and tried to turn it into, you know, it's something that it's not. I mean, when you get to the point where Hillary Clinton, who as Secretary of State kept an unsecured server you know, filled with classified information that got hacked by the Russians, the Chinese, and God knows who else, lecturing us about protecting classified information.
It's unbelievable.
It's a joke.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, if you could have picked the single worst person to make this case, it would have been Hillary Clinton, and the Democrats picked her. With that said, the White House has to track down, and that they probably have, how this happened, whether it was a mistake by Waltz or one of the people on the chat, or, I mean, you got to remember, these phones were set up by and given to them by White House employees, you know, when they got there and maybe even before. So, you know, was this a mistake or was this a setup? And I don't know. But even if it was a mistake, I would call it, you know, somewhere between a 2 and a 4. It's not a firing offense, but, you know, someone should get slapped around and lectured to.
Well, beyond that, what I think, and this seemingly is died off, but I really would love to have an answer to the question, how in the world did, you know, the dude from The Atlantic, Jeffrey Goldberg's name, get looped into all this? Because the explanations given so far just don't make sense.
No. And, you know, I mean, it's not like it was just some rando. I mean, this is Jeffrey Goldberg, the guy who created the Suckers and Losers hoax. You know, so one of the two or three tentpole hoaxes that has been used against Donald Trump, you know, that he called people in the military who died suckers and losers. I mean, any sane person knows that's not true. Every person in the military certainly knows it's not true because they all love Trump. You know, they know that this is, you know, I mean, he got endorsed by everyone who, you know, the families of all the soldiers who died because of Joe Biden and Lloyd Austin. So, you know, the fact that he in particular was on this Signal chat tells you that something super weird happened. I mean, the one thing that would make me revise the judgment that Waltz shouldn't be fired is being told that he chats with Jeffrey Goldberg on Signal. I mean, that is a red flag. And so, you know, I'd like to know how, why, in what possible world should you be talking to a rabid, lying anti-Trumper? Now, I have no reason to believe that he did, and I'd like to know how that guy got into somebody's, you know, I mean, it just should not have happened.
Yeah, it's confusing because the answers really aren't giving us any clarity on that. And let's kind of talk about the politics of yesteryear, the Joe Biden administration, because there seems to be this continuous effort for all these people who knew what was going on to start talking about how the other people weren't reporting on what we knew was going on, like Chris Cillizza, who was at CNN, who's now doing a podcast.
The fact that the Biden inner circle clearly knew he was diminished. They kept him from the media. They insisted to the media he was fine, even while knowing he was not. I have a feeling that by the end of May, Joe Biden and his inner circle are going to even be more persona non grata than they are right now in the Democratic Party.
I don't know what you think about that, but it's so funny to hear guys like Cillizza talking about this when he should have been one of the guys reporting on all this when it was happening and wasn't.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, basically, the Pravda media, and that's what I call them. I mean, they're just Pravda. It has shifted from, you know, fact-checking any critique of Joe Biden to not only defending themselves, but basically their defense is we're so darned incompetent that we couldn't see what, you know, a six-year-old out in, you know, sort of podunk nowhere, knew. You know, they were the palace guard until he was gone. Now they're doing their now it can be told stories and expecting us to trust them on those and everything else. While at the, you know, either they were lying before, which they were, or yeah. they're grotesquely incompetent, in which case they should be run out of the business.
So what do you think? You wrote about this, and I spent some time on this Wisconsin Supreme Court case in the last hour. I think it's really going to be close. Jessica McBride, who is a friend and a reporter up there, said that she saw some new polling that shows that it's just a dead heat. So we'll see what happens in that. But there's a couple other races tomorrow that we know the legacy media, if they don't go in the Republicans' direction, will paint as this big signal that the country in 4 months has completely turned around in the other direction, right?
Yeah, they'll say that, and that won't be true, but something else that's not good will be, which is MAGA only turns out when Trump is on the ballot. And, you know, that's not as bad as the entire country turning on Trump, and the polls definitely show that they're not. But what it will show is that the support is limited to Trump. It's less about his agenda. It's less about all the issues that you and I care about and more about getting behind your guy. And that's an element of politics, but that's not how you win in the long term. And so my sort of big question for tomorrow is, will Trump supporters turn out when he's not on the ballot?
The problem is the ballot is not equal. All things are not equal. In other words, everybody knows they're supposed to go out in November. It's a presidential election. People who don't vote at any other time in their lives will vote in a general election. They may not go out for a primary. They're certainly not going out for a school board election in April, right? So things being equal concerns me because you're going to have activists, people who are supported by unions. Money gets people out. It's different than a general. There's no doubt about that.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, just to be clear, the Democrats have an absolute unquestionable advantage in any election that's not presidential because they can. I mean, their base is public employees, public employee unions, teachers unions, the Service Employees International unions, and those people can be counted to get out because it's their bread and butter. I mean, they're actually voting on whether they're going to get a pay raise. You know, they're all radical leftists. So they start out with an enormous advantage. This is why school board races are, you know, almost always won by the left, because the teachers unions go in knowing who the candidates are. They have a list that has been handed to them. Vote for this person and you will get a raise. You will, you know, no oversight, no school choice. And so it requires an extraordinary amount of energy to get non-public employees out in these off-year and off-day elections.
The real story would be if Brad Schimmel actually defeats Susan Crawford in Wisconsin, because that will really be something. I still think it's going to be a very close race, and I'd have to guess, just because of the weirdness of Wisconsin, that she probably wins, but we'll have to see. David Strom, always great to have you on. I appreciate it. Thank you so much on this Monday.
All right. Thanks, Mark.
Paul Morrow coming up to talk about the Karen Reed second trial, which kicks off tomorrow with jury selection in Boston.
Hey, I'm Andy. If you don't know me, it's probably because I'm not famous. But I did start a men's grooming company called Harry's. The idea for Harry's came out of a frustrating experience I had buying razor blades. Most brands were overpriced, overdesigned, and out of touch. At Harry's, our approach is simple. Here's our secret. We make sharp, durable blades and sell them at honest prices for as low as $2 each. We care about quality so much that we do some crazy things, like buy a world-class German blade factory. Obsessing over every detail means we're confident in offering a 100% quality guarantee. Millions of guys have already made the switch to Harry's, so thank you if you're one of them. And if you're not, we hope you give us a try with this special offer. Get a Harry starter set with a 5-blade razor, weighted handle, shave gel, and a travel cover. All for just $3 plus free shipping. Just go to harrys.com and enter code MAN at checkout. That's harrys.com, code MAN. Enjoy.
The Women's Hoop Show, a podcast hosted by me, Jordan Robinson, brings you fresh women's basketball voices and breakdowns every week. I'll be joined by hoop experts all year long. Find the Women's Hoop Show on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I kind of like that little Sue, History in the Lewis Sue promo there.
How about it?
We call that inventory.
Yeah,
right? Inventory,
yes.
Commercial and promo. You got some inventory on the show. I'm very proud of you, Sue. That's
Thank
great.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
We have an audio cut of the day coming up here before the end of the hour, but I'm so excited. I told Fred this morning, I really want to talk about this Karen Reed thing because I got so into the documentary on Max, and I said, Fred, you got to find out if Paul Morrow's on top of this. And he is, of course, Fox News contributor, retired NYPD inspector, attorney, and a founder of the opsdesk.org, which is a great site. How are you, Paul, this afternoon?
Doing good, Mark. How are you?
I'm good. Here's my quick take on Karen Reed. I think she did it. I think there's a lot of reasonable doubt. I think the prosecution was a mess, and it was a good TV show. Outside of that, I don't know much more.
Yeah, you know what? That's as fair a summary as any. In the prosecution's defense, they were a little overmatched. My understanding is that they were a little under-resourced, and they came up against a really first-rate defense attorney, somebody who's used to the camera, who knew how to work the room, Alan Jackson. He's going to be there the second time around as well. But this time, it's going to be quite different because Jackson is facing a much more experienced prosecutor who's had time to get his legs under him. And my understanding is that the atmosphere up there in the courtroom these days is quite different than the first time around. Jackson's been losing motions left and right. Brennan, that's the new prosecutor, has been quite aggressive at holding the line. The judge seems to tilt to the prosecution now because there seems to have been some indicia of irregularities, let's call them, on the defense side. And so Jackson seems a little rattled, so this is really going to be fascinating.
So let's back up a little bit and give the details of what happened here. This goes back to, I think, 2022. It was a snowy night in January. Everyone was out at a bar. He's a Boston police officer. They're hanging out with other cops. It's a bunch of people that get together and are friends on a regular basis. Then they decide to go to another friend's house who's a police officer, and that's where kind of things change dramatically, right?
Yeah, so they're out drinking, and she's got, that is, Karen Reed is with her close boyfriend, who's also a police officer. His name's O'Keefe, and they go, he's relatively new to the area. He's taking care of the children of his deceased sister, so he stepped up to do that, and he's relatively new to the area. They don't know him that well, but they like what they see, and they invite him back to this home. The problem is Karen Reed doesn't know any of these people. And so apparently she did not want to go. That's not in dispute. And in fact, he has to get directions. It's not like he knows them so well. He has to get directions to go there to the house because he doesn't know the area and he doesn't know the people. So they get to the house, and that's where the stories diverge. Her story is that he got out of the car, went to the front steps, was going to give her a high sign as to whether or not it was, quote unquote, okay to go in. And she has said this in the interviews that she's giving. I wasn't sure we'd be welcome and all sort of stuff. And so I was waiting for him to kind of give me the thumbs up. He goes in the house and he doesn't reemerge. I don't know what to make of it. I have to go to the bathroom. I'd had 9 drinks.
Yeah.
She weighs like 100 pounds, this woman. She's had 9 drinks with reportedly a New England thing called a sidecar, which is essentially a shot on the side with some of these 9 drinks. So she's pretty banged up. But anyway, her story is that he doesn't reemerge, and so she has to go to the bathroom, and so she drives herself to his house and goes to sleep on his couch, and she wakes up to the fact that he hasn't come home.
But she also calls his cell phone, I think they indicated, 53 times that morning, saying, cussing him out, John, where are you? John, this. Now, I don't know if the theory is that she did that to create cover for, you know, for doing this. I legit, Paul, think that she might not even realize that she ran him over because she was so intoxicated. So then that leads me to, you know, why did they charge second-degree murder? Because this seems to be, no matter what you think about Karen Reed and whether she did it, second-degree murder seems to be overcharging here to me.
So that's a very salient point. And I got to tell you, that's kind of where I was for a long time here. I couldn't figure out why they went with murder two. And a lot of very experienced assessors here, people who work in criminal justice, have said, well, one of the reasons that the first jury hung is that they overcharged. Here's the nuance.
Okay.
And I agree with your assessment, by the way, because when you hear those messages that she leaves him, that she's not acting. She thinks he's alive. She's furious at him. She's cursing him out. And she gets kind of particular. It's like at one point she's calling him a pervert.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know if something went on in a car with them or what, but like she's really pretty mad at him and she thinks he's potentially getting these messages. I don't think she's actor enough to have faked that. No, she's alive. She thinks he's alive. Here's the thing. She intended to hit him. You would need to get the murder charge. You would need an intentional murder. Murder two is what the charge is up there. She intended, however, in my estimation, and I think in the prosecution's estimation, to hit him with the car. Now, if you intend to commit a felony and then somebody dies in the commission of that felony, you have felony murder. Now, generally, felony murder off of an assault, if off an intended assault, just gets marbled into manslaughter. And that's it. Apparently not the case in Massachusetts.
Okay.
This is what I am being told. Because I cannot come up, and I have to buy it, because I can't really come up with another theory as to why you would be so dogged in charging the murder, too. You could say it was the fact that she didn't render aid or something like that. You could come up with some novel theory. The fact that she knew he didn't come home, knew that she hit him with the car, didn't go to check on him. You could try to come up with some theory like that. But the best answer I've gotten from somebody who does, you know, should know, is that under the felony murder charge, that is, you intended to commit another felony, which in this case would be assault with a weapon, the weapon being the car, and then he dies, you have the felony murder charge. The classic example you always hear is, okay, you go in to rob a bank.
Yeah, right, right.
And as you're fleeing, you shoot because somebody steps in front of you, or you shot up in the air to try to scare somebody, to bullet somebody.
Still
murder. And now you
charge.
Got felony murder.
Yep, exactly.
Right.
Yeah, well, like even if Sue and I go and rob a bank, and I shoot someone and I kill someone, Sue can still be charged with felony murder because she was taking part in the bank robbery. And Sue's a big bank robber, too, so that wouldn't be that would not be too much of a stretch. You know, one of the things, Paul, I've said in this circumstance is because I'm very familiar with the situation with the Stephen Avery case from Wisconsin and making a murder. And there's not a guy on the planet that's more guilty than Stephen Avery. But that show made it seem like he wasn't guilty. So there's a big difference in what a TV series does and a documentary than what's reality. So I know I didn't sit in that courtroom every day. I do see reasonable doubt. I see some weird things, too. Like, you know, the people that were inside the house, Sue, including an ATF agent and other cops, there were phone calls that they tracked from there that were claiming to be butt dials. So the calls were made back and forth. It was an abnormal, like an unbelievable amount, like 9 butt dials, which
no one would
believe. So there's weird stuff like that, Paul, that also happens that really does lend to the reasonable doubt. But again, unless you're in that courtroom for the whole trial, you wouldn't really know all that.
Yeah, I think that you're right. There are some aspects of it. To me, you know, the phone calls can be teased out. There might have been something else they were discussing. For whatever reason, they're not coming out. Who knows? I mean, the cops, maybe they were trying to order up some weed or something. And, you know, I really don't know what it is that would be would explain the fact that there were butt dials that nobody wants to sort of or there are phone calls that nobody wants to really explain beyond saying, hey, butt dial.
It is weird.
It is weird, but to me, the dispositive piece in her favor that I understand why the jury had some real trouble convicting here is the Google search.
Yes.
That, to me, is the real, because it's digital, and apparently the data can be interpreted a different way, but just to tease it out real quick, there is on one of the witnesses, one of the fellow attendees at the party, there is a Google search that occurs at around the 2:30 hour, saying how long to die in the snow, essentially.
Oof. Well, they even misspelled it. It says HOS. So they because people do that, right? It says HOS.
Yeah, right. She misspelled how long. So, but, you know, it's pretty clear she meant how long. So, you know, the interpretation that came out at trial that I think really swayed the jury, and my understanding is that in some interviews, et cetera, after the case, some of the witnesses have alluded to the fact that that really swung them. And, you know, the idea was that at 2:30, this person who was at the party, this woman who has absolutely nothing against O'Keefe, none of the people at the party seemed to, she was Googling how long to die in the snow well before it had come to light that he was, in fact, dead in a snowbank. And so she must have known that he was out there and dying, and they were waiting for that to happen. But apparently, the company they use to dump the phone is a company called Celebrate. It's their software. I'm very familiar with them. And that data has some leeway in how it's interpreted. And in fact, that leeway came to light to such an extent during the trial that Cellebrite went in and changed their software because in their estimation, and in the estimation of a lot of other experts, what happened was that the phone had remained open. It had never closed. That this woman, Jennifer McCabe, that's her name, that was at the party, went home herself at about 2:30, went to bed. The phone didn't lock for some reason, or Google stayed open.
Safari, I think Safari, yes, Safari stayed open. So the case that they made
is... Safari, the browser stayed open,
The case that they make does sound somewhat feasible, but I checked on this. So what they're saying is, because then you get to the point where there's a bunch of Google searches, but they're at 6:30 in the morning. The prosecution has experts that claim, well, look, she had Safari open, so at 6:30, because it was open from 2 a.m., that's when the search is indicated. But I checked with George Rosenthal, one of our IT experts here with ThrottleNet, and he says this. The ethical hacker that he asked the question of said all those searches would show up in history, assuming history wasn't cleared, additional steps taken to cover tracks, etc. It organizes by date and in order, but if you don't see a timestamp exactly on the regular view, forensics could find the exact time of each search and how they're spelled. My question was, did we just miss that because the documentary doesn't show everything that happened in the trial? I'm guessing that's going to be further clarified in this trial, and you're going to get some more answers, because I can understand how the jury would be confused by that, Paul.
Exactly. And there's two metrics that you could use there, because first of all, you could go to the company that owns Safari. In this case, it's going to be Apple, and you're going to get their logs and say, okay, dump the log. And this happens in cases all the time. They got Brian Koberg's Google searches. They got the Google searches from Rex Heuerman out here on Long Island,
right,
in New York over here, who killed, allegedly, a bunch of prostitutes. So, you know, you could get that, or you could get the metrics from the phone itself. That is, you dump the phone and you get essentially like a keystroke, for lack of a better term. And you can see what was punched into the phone at what time. And from my understanding, what I've seen, and again, I wasn't in that courtroom, but I'm pretty familiar with it. My understanding is that what they went with was, again, the Cellebrite dump of the actual activity on the phone. And that's where the wiggle room seems to come in. And the phone, if in fact was active, that Safari remained open, then the prosecution's contention is that, like you said, in the 6 o'clock hour after the body was found, and that's Jen McCabe's testimony, by the way, that at that point, Karen Reed said to her, check how long it takes to die in the snow. Google that. That she, in fact, did it at Karen Reed's instruction.
Oh, which makes sense,
though. That would be a whole different... Okay.
It is, but it does make sense. But I can also see how it, plants reasonable doubt. Look, the whole case, Paul, is... Did you watch the documentary or not? Did you watch the series?
I participated in a documentary on Fox Nation that covered the case. So I'm aware there's another one out there. I don't know what...
Yeah, that's the one on Max that's drawn a lot of people. Look, they timed it out, so it's right before this trial. It's a really, really well-done series. But again, that doesn't mean that it reflects the truth of what happened. But one thing I was going to tell you is, the one thing that... There's a lot of things, Paul, that jump out at certain people, and for you in particular, as someone who's been in law enforcement as an attorney. The prosecutor in this case that they first assigned... I've been in courtrooms, Paul. I've seen prosecution. He might have been the worst prosecutor I've ever seen in my entire life. He was so bad. He had no personality. He was fumbling over himself. It was really, really bad. Now, again, selective, cuts, because I'm seeing it in a documentary. But they moved on from that dude. They got a new guy in here, and I think he's got to do better, because there's no one that could possibly do worse than the other guy. That's what I'd say.
This guy, Brennan, is apparently sharp as a tack, very, very experienced, former prosecutor and a former defense attorney. So he knows both sides of the aisle here. And my understanding is, as I said, they've really... Look, they don't want to lose this.
It would be devastating.
Because,
Yeah, but see, the thing that makes this unique is, and this is why it's a little, sleazy as well, is as soon as she's, prosecuted for this, they bring in the Netflix cameras, the documentary team. So this documentary is with her every day of the trial. You have all these people, we haven't even addressed this, all these fans of hers that will probably be there tomorrow cheering her on. They're wearing pink. She's become this cult, this pop culture hero, because a lot of people think that it's malfeasance on the part of the Boston Police Department. It's an inside job and all this stuff. So the case is fascinating. I get why people are, interested in it, but wow, it's a mess. That's for sure, too.
It is. And, look, at the end of the day, for this to have been the conspiracy that Jackson, the defense attorney, conjured, that he got the jury to buy into, you would have to have five different agencies and about 25 people, none of whom we can demonstrate all definitely know each other. In fact, highly likely they don't. You got the medical examiner's office, you got the fire department, you got Boston PD, you got all these other people that show up. They all would have had to have a reason to, and then the time to sit down, work out this elaborate plan for some reason, all of these people being career law enforcement. Yeah, let's get this guy back for no motive that's clear to any of us.
That's the problem.
Get him in the basement.
Yeah, there's no motive.
Beat him to death and stick the dog on him and then leave him in the snow in front of our house, by the way.
Yes, yeah,
all of it. Find. And then when they do the investigation from the federal side to see, remember, and this goes to the butt dialing you were talking about earlier. Remember, the feds came in and looked at this case for police misconduct. That's how far Jackson pushed this.
Yeah.
He had this theory so complete that the feds came in and did an assessment to see, do we have a police misconduct case here? And not, and that hung over the first trial. Well, not only was there no indictments on the federal side, but in fact, the federal case was closed with no indictments, which is essentially an endorsement of the fact that there was no collusion, no conspiracy on the police side. Expect that to come in this time as well.
We have made this, and they've done this because they made a movie. We made it so complicated. I swear, Paul, I think it's pretty simple. I think that there is a lot of alcohol going on with all these people, and we all know people that are in these cliques. I can name a few here in certain parts of St. Louis. I think they were out. They got way liquored up. She got pissed because she's crazy. I think John O'Keefe was a little crazy himself, and she ran him over. And she might not even remember it because she was so wasted. But we're going to see what's going to happen in the second trial, Paul Morrow. We're going to have you be our correspondent. So I appreciate it. Thank you.
You got it, buddy.
All right, take care.
Thank you.
Audio cut of the day is coming up. Audio cut of the day coming up here. We also have tickets this week to give away to see Clint Black at the Family Arena. Something tells me that Sue Thomas has met Clint Black back in your country radio days,
he's
right?
He's super nice. And he's just a little taller than me. These are the things I remember.
April 12th is the show. If you're caller number 5, Ethan will award you the pair of tickets right now on the contest line, 314-241-9797. You're a winner from 97.1 FM Talk, and we will have tickets. I was thinking audio cut of the day. Well, tickets giveaway all day, every day this week.
I get it.
In other words, I have more tickets later in the week, but let's do this.
Stand by. Playback ready.
Now, the audio cut of the day.
All right. President Trump has said some things that I have not yet heard because Fred dumped these in here this afternoon. So every once in a while, we'll do an audio cut of the day that I'm not vetting completely. But he was asked about the Wisconsin race. We talked about that quite a bit. The Supreme Court race tomorrow.
It's a big race, Supreme Court race in Wisconsin. It's taking place essentially as it was early voting. So we'll see what happens. It's a big race. I love Wisconsin. We won Wisconsin. Republicans typically don't do very well in Wisconsin, but I did. I actually won it twice. I actually probably won it three times, to be exact.
We played there, sir.
Not probably. I won it three times. We had a rigged election the second time, but that's, one of those things.
All right. So anyway, he goes on about that. And if you'd like to find out everything you need to know about that particular race, you can use the rewind function. Listen to Jessica McBride, who's an investigative reporter in Milwaukee. She joined me at 4:20. Here's another question that came up. This was Peter Ducey, because Tiger Woods went on Instagram yesterday and said, "Love is in the air and life is better with you by my side." He was talking about Vanessa Trump, who used to be married to Don Jr.
What is your thought about Tiger Woods now becoming part of the broader Trump family?
Well, I love Tiger, and I love Vanessa, and they had a great relationship. I happen to think the relationship with my son, I happen to think the relationship was hurt very badly by the witch hunt that went on, Russia, 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 and all the crap that they put Don through. Who knew nothing about it? But Vanessa and Don had a very good relationship. They have incredible children, 5 incredible children, all good athletes, all great students, they're like great. And they broke up, quite a while ago, and which was to me very sad because I think they're both great. Don and Vanessa and Tiger actually called me a few months ago, and I have a very special, very good relationship with Tiger. I played golf with him a couple of times over the last month, and he's a fantastic guy and a fantastic athlete, and he told me about it. And I said, "Tiger, that's good. That's good. I'm very happy for both. I just let them both be happy. Let them both be happy. They're both great."
That might be the most diplomatic I've ever heard Donald J. Trump in my entire life on any issue.
That was great.
I liked it. It was heartwarming. There you go. Have a great night. We'll talk tomorrow at 3.
Get more at 971talk.com.